PFT Media.
This special episode of The Experience was recorded while following all advised rules of safety for the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is The Experience with Chris Fio. In each episode, Fio brings his unique and unashamed interview style to Central Florida. He conducts honest and open interviews with people that have the vocabulary and expertise that he lacks.
In this episode, I get to talk with a person I admire very much, Gina Duncan. She is the director of gender equality at Equality Florida. Duncan shares her journey as she transitioned from being a married father of two to being the person she always knew she was. Gina is another one of my guests that has become a hero of mine.
Hustler, gun in a holster. That vision is slipping like a worn transmission. The days of transporting and not transmitting because the transcontinental.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. I want to preface this by saying, as a local community advocate and an ally for the LGBT community, it is an honor to have you on this podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
You're welcome. And I've done this with Anna Eskamani before. I've had her introduce her full name and title to the audience, and I would like for you to do the same.
Be glad to. I'm Gina Duncan, and I'm the statewide director of transgender equality at Equality Florida. And you might know Equality Florida is the state's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, currently with over 300,000 members across the state.
And you do amazing work from what I've studied. You have events that garnish over 100,000 people a year to come to Orlando.
Yeah.
That is truly amazing, and the work you do for us and in the community is amazing.
Well, thank you. We've got an amazing team. At this point, Equality Florida has roughly 40 employees across the state.
Wow.
In working in areas from my area, which is our transgender inclusion initiative, to our safe and healthy schools, HIV advocacy and support, our Equality Means Business platform, and of course, our public policy team, who is always working to pass legislation that's LGBTQ friendly and push back against harmful LGBTQ measures that are introduced across the state.
We need more people like you in this world. We need more people to do what you're doing and more.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I wanted to get right into it with you and bring up my first question. As a young married man before your transition with two children, how difficult was your journey of self-discovery?
Well, it was difficult, I have to say. But over the years, I've found that my journey has been better than most. I knew at an early age that I was transgender. I remember when I was like 6 years old, my sisters invited me to a dress-up party. And when they finished putting fingernail polish on me and lipstick, and they put this little flowery dress on me, I felt for the first time that I could breathe. And I knew that that was who I really was, even at that early age. But back then, there weren't any resources. You know, there wasn't any dialogue about this back in the 50s and 60s. So life kind of got in the way.
I bet it had to.
Yeah, and I came from a large family. I have two brothers and two sisters. And we traveled a lot around the country before we settled in Florida over in Merritt Island. But my journey as a young man was certainly something that was, even though I was dealing with gender dysphoria, I had a very positive experience as a guy.
Oh, wow.
Which is funny to say. You know, you've lived half your life as a guy and half your life, hopefully, as a woman. And the dynamics of living a life in two genders has been totally fascinating.
I bet so it has, and that I'll bring that up as a question later on in the podcast with you. And as speaking of a younger you, what type of person was Greg?
Well, Greg, actually, a lot of people in our community, you know, they call their old name their dead name, and they don't like to talk about those times when they're dealing with a lot of gender dysphoria.
That's interesting to know.
Yeah, and it's everyone's experience is different. And their transition journey is certainly different. I had a very positive experience growing up as a young man. And even though I was dealing with gender dysphoria and I would need my fix of, you know, every 30 or 90 days I would steal some lipstick from my mom or an item of her clothing, and I'd sneak into the bathroom, and I would just be able to once again breathe briefly and feel my true and authentic self. And that got harder over the years, but as a young man, I was fortunate in that I actually excelled in a lot of things. I was the class president from sixth grade all the way through high school. Junior high, high school, I was elected class president at Merritt Island High School. I was the homecoming king. I was the captain of an undefeated state championship football team that year. So
it's safe to say from a young starting age, you had it all together and you had some incredible ambition behind you.
Thanks to an amazing set of parents who really believed in us and often told us that we can do and we can be whatever we want to do and be if we just really focus on it and believe in it. And so I was fortunate in the fact that I achieved a lot of the things that made my teenage years very, very positive.
That is really wonderful to hear that. You know, just to hear that even though you were dealing with troubles of, you know, your own self-identity, you still were able to be positive and create such an outcome for yourself in that way.
Yeah, but it was also, I was on this collision course in that with each passing year, I found that I more and more needed to be my true self. I would take more risks. I would, you know, I remember my brother one time catching me in the restroom putting on one of my mom's dresses. And I asked him now if he ever remembered that. Unfortunately, he doesn't for some reason, but I was horrified that I was going to finally be outed in my family, but he didn't, and I downplayed it, so he did too. I guess he didn't think there was anything wrong with it.
Yeah, he probably thought it was just child's imagination, maybe.
Yeah, kind of exploring as a young person.
Yeah, because every child has worn their mother's clothing at one point. I have too. I've, you know, donned her high heels at one time,
right,
and tried to dance on the counters.
Yeah,
because my mom used to work at King Andrew's Feast, and one of their jobs was like, you know, just entertainment, like doing the old the wench dances, you know, where their feet move at a million miles a minute, and I would try to copy that.
Yeah,
I was like, wow, that's so cool, Mom.
Yeah, but it was a little bit of a dichotomy in living that dual life, in the fact that the older I got, the more I needed to do to be happy. Gender dysphoria was truly becoming more and more a part of my life. I got a football scholarship to go to North Carolina and play at East Carolina University. I was an all-state or an all-conference strong safety at East Carolina. I soon came back to Florida and got into the banking field and was fortunate in the fact that I excelled there. I spent the last 17 years of my career as the regional manager with Wells Fargo.
Go off a little off script with that one. How did you get so good at being a banker? You moved up the ranks so quick. Was there any techniques you developed?
You know, I don't know. It really suited me because I was always interested in leadership and in politics and motivating people and that kind of thing. I was vice president of the student body up at East Carolina, the first non-Greek elected. Yeah, so I'm playing football up at East Carolina. I was vice president of the student body. So when I got into mortgage banking, I certainly wanted to be more than a loan officer. So I learned quickly. I moved up in the ranks. And as I said, I spent the last 17 years with Wells Fargo as their regional manager, overseeing 26 branches from Jacksonville to Miami, 285 employees, a multi-million dollar budget. And faithfully, at Wells Fargo was also when I decided to transition.
Yeah. And how was the team there during your transition? How did they reciprocate?
Well, it was interesting because I did my research, and a lot of these foundational steps that Wells Fargo took, and part of the research is what are now a foundational aspect of the trainings that I do. I do transgender cultural competency trainings to major corporations all across the country. And in doing that, I experienced Wells Fargo taking exactly the right steps. I told my boss, he assured me that my job was not in danger, that they would build a support system around me and they would support me in my transition process. I soon heard from a human resources person out in San Francisco, our home office, who said, you should know that you'll be the 17th person at Wells Fargo to transition on the job.
Really? That must have been such a sigh of relief.
Yeah, it was amazingly positive. And on one hand, I was thinking that I was, you know, something special, but for Wells Fargo, it was just chopped liver. It was like so progressive. You know, they're enjoying some, sadly, some bumps in the road and tough times right now, but Wells Fargo has always been a very employee-centric company and a very customer service company up until recently, but they certainly walk the talk in reference to diversity and inclusion. When I transitioned at Wells, I told my boss, he assured me that I had their full support, and I took some time off to go out to California to have facial feminization surgery. And I learned later that during that time that they flew in a SWAT team. They had a transgender cultural competency SWAT team that came in to work with my different branches, work with my staff, and educate them on what it meant to be transgender, what it means to transition, so that when I came back to work, it was a real positive experience.
That is wonderful to hear that. You don't hear much companies, let alone big companies, taking steps and initiatives to do stuff like that.
Yeah, and this was back in 2006.
Wow, so it's unheard of in 2006.
Yeah.
This is like before the 30-day challenge came out. I'm not sure if you know what the 30-day challenge is, but it was started by a transgender man who was transitioning from a woman to a man, and it was about his voice and how it would change with the hormone boosters they had, and that was the origins of the 30-day challenge, just to educate my audience a little bit on that as well, you know, just in case they don't know. And I'm really happy to hear that for you. I'm just stunned.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. Sadly, a lot of transgender people that transition, you know, in midlife or whatever, it's not as positive. And that's part of the education process. That's really why Equality Florida launched our workshops that we do all over the country and support major corporations to build policy and protocol and how to really support their transgender employees and now non-binary employees.
That is amazing. And we will get to the subject of non-binary and later in this interview as well. We got plenty to cover today.
Sounds good.
Yep. We're going to jump back a little on script. And my next question is, how much of Greg is in Gina today?
You know, I like to think that the best of Greg is still with me. You know, I know that growing up and dealing with gender dysphoria was painful. And oftentimes, after I started working and I got married, I found that after I got married and we had two children, a boy and a girl, I realized as the days went by that gender dysphoria became more and more severe. And while my family was very close, and we still are to a great extent, I knew that at some point I needed to do something to be truly happy. I never felt like I was totally in the moment. I never felt like I was totally engaged. So part of Greg, to answer your question more directly, lives on. I like to think the best part of Greg is still there in reference to my goal to be a community leader, to improve things around us, to support the transgender and the whole LGBTQ community, and to work with our elected officials to change policies so that, you know, we do enjoy the same rights and protections that everyone else does in the country. And that led me to, in 2012, running for county commissioner. The first openly transgender person to run for office.
That is historic.
In Central Florida. Yeah. I lost, sadly.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, but I garnered 40% of the vote. So, you know, people said it was a moral victory, but...
very progressive moral victory.
Well, it was a good start, and I think it was a good educational platform to educate a lot more people in reference to what it meant to be transgender.
I want to ask you a question that will help educate me and my audience. Why do some people identify as transgender, gender nonconforming, genderqueer, and non-binary?
Well, it's important to note that our community, which includes all of those different subcategories, being transgender or non-binary is an umbrella term. And we're all as dissimilar as those different categories. To be transgender means that your assigned sex at birth does not align with your deeply held belief of who you are and how you relate with the world, your gender identity. And we've heard that term used a lot, of course, in the recent Supreme Court ruling that the term, you know, sex being a protected class included sexual orientation and gender identity. So a lot of training and education we do is around understanding the concept of one's gender identity. The way you feel about yourself may or may not align with the body that you were born in or your assigned sex at birth. So that denotes a transgender person. Trans meaning movement from one thing to another. Within our transgender community, we also have a vibrant and emerging non-binary community. And that basically means that non-binary people reject the social constructs of having to be or identifying as either male or female. There's no reason why you can't identify as both, as neither, a fluid combination of both. So our non-binary community within the trans community is a rapidly emerging part of our community that is in need of support, and there certainly is a lot more education. You know, I often think when we talk about the non-binary community that oftentimes non-binary identities use they, them, their as their pronouns. And that takes some education. When we're working with major corporations, we not only train on transgender people, binary transgender people who transition from male to female or female to male, but now we also talk about non-binary people. Non-conforming was a term that was used for that community. Queer identifying, which basically means that they don't want to be stuck in the social constructs of my generation, that they want to be free to express themselves any way they want, and that can change. So there's not necessarily a transient or a trans piece of that. It's that it's a process of them finding themselves and being happy in the way they want to present and the pronouns they want to use.
That sounds actually beautiful. Like to just be happy and discover your full self, even if it's not a social conforming thing. I view that as beautiful and something that should flourish.
Absolutely. I remember a situation several years ago when Chaz Bono was, I had the good fortune of being on a panel and then being able to introduce Chaz Bono when he came to UCF. And this kind of speaks to the beautiful rainbow that our community is as far as gender identity. And standing up at that podium and looking out over this auditorium of over 200 young people were there, 200 students from UCF, and looking around the room, you could just feel the energy. You could feel the love. You could feel the camaraderie. And looking over the audience, it was hard to determine what gender, you know, anyone was. You know, it was a very gender fluid, gender non-conforming group. Yet the energy was palpable. The energy was absolutely palpable. And it's something that I'll never forget, in that, to me, that was a glimpse of the future, you know, that we'll move past these social constructs of gender, of binary genders, of maleness and femaleness that oftentimes divides us more than brings us together. And it'll be more like that auditorium that day, where everyone could just simply be their authentic selves, and they were accepted and affirmed and validated by their friends.
That's perfect, and that's that's something I hope that we can progress towards, because for people to truly feel like they can accept themselves, is it starts with society. It starts with us viewing these people as they are that being them true their true selves, because happy means to them they're progressing towards a goal that they view as their reality.
Yeah, and I think what we all have in common in the entire, you know, alphabet soup of LGBTQIA, et cetera, is that everyone simply wants to be able to live an authentic life, you know, to be their true selves, express themselves as they wish, and simply be able to, you know, carve out their own piece of the American dream as their authentic self. And that's what it's all about.
I agree with you. That is 100% the dream, and I can't see why anybody doesn't want anybody else to pursue that. It just seems just regressive, very regressive to me.
Well, it is. I have to tell you that in doing this work, that I still am often surprised by the vitriol and the hate against the LGBTQ community simply for wanting to love who you want to love or be who you want to be, you know, without impacting anyone else, to simply find your own happiness without infringing on anyone else's rights or protections. So oftentimes it's hurtful to see, you know, the opposition to legislation in Tallahassee, or, you know, legislation that is introduced to negatively impact the LGBTQ community.
And I want to say that I will say sorry on behalf of the people who mostly do that. Straight cisgendered men mostly have a hand in doing that. I can tell, and I'm not afraid to say that. And it shocks me by the amount of transphobia that permeates our society with straight young cisgendered men. And it just makes me want to ask you, how can people like me, how can I get more people like me to be better allies to the transgender community?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I really appreciate you asking that. What we find is that people fear the unknown, or they fear what they don't understand. So we find that when there are safe spaces created and transgender people are invited to the table, the more people know transgender people, the more they understand that they're not a predator in a bathroom. You know, they're not a pedophile. They're not, you know, committing crimes or whatever. There's so much false rhetoric that's levied against the transgender community, and none of it's true. You know, again, the community is simply wanting to live an authentic life. So our allies, just in simply creating spaces so people are welcome, and then are affirmed when they're there, they're included in the process, they're included in the discussion, and they're validated as simply being who they want to be, and that's okay. You know, it's interesting that in corporate meetings, oftentimes this comes up in our trainings, about going through the group, whoever's meeting, and everyone giving their pronouns. There's been pushback against, you know, some employees say, why do I have to do that, you know? But it seems like a minor thing, but it's super important in validating, for example, a non-binary person in the room, to be able to say that their pronouns are they, them, there. And some people in the room might go, I did not know that, and I would have totally misgendered you and used she or he. And just by everyone giving their pronouns, it validates the person in the room. And it creates safe spaces for bringing more people into the room. You know, I found when I first came out and I was president of the MBA, the Metropolitan Business Association, is now the Pride Chamber, but we would have mixers and events, and so often I felt like I was the only transgender person in the room. But due to the LGBTQ community in Orlando being so inclusive and so amazing, our numbers have grown and people have felt safe to come out of the shadows and attend galas, attend mixers, be spokespeople in the community. And so it's been an amazing growth just since 2010, let's say, that the transgender and non-binary community is so much more visible. And visibility leads to people having an increased awareness and education, and through that awareness and education is where we'll get to equality for the community.
That doesn't sound like too much to ask at all.
It doesn't, does it?
No, it doesn't. Just, you know, just be more conscious of people. Be nicer. You know, like, if someone wants you to use their pronoun, use it. That's not asking too much, I don't think. It's not like saying, hey, give me $1 million every time you talk to me. That's how I think some people react.
Yeah, surprising for some people it is. It's like, that's just too confusing. I'm not going to do that. And what they don't understand is they're basically invalidating that person, you know, by using an incorrect pronoun for them. They're basically dismissing their gender identity and the way they feel about themselves and the way they want to be accepted in the world.
Yeah, so that's like someone, you know, going up to you and calling you a he, or someone calling me a she. We don't identify like that. That's rude. That's very rude and outright, it's a bully tactic, I believe, too.
It really is. It's funny that in the workshops I do, when we get to pronouns and talking about that, I'll pick out I'll pick out the most masculine, kind of virile guy in the room. And I said, just for an exercise, if you don't mind, for the rest of the workshop, we're going to refer to you with female pronouns.
Okay.
And then I'd kind of walk away. And you see, usually the gentleman isn't really happy with that. He's a little squirming in his seat a little bit. And I come back and say, I apologize if I made you uncomfortable there. But the point is, that's how people feel when they're misgendered. You know, that's not who you are. If I called you she and her, you obviously identify as male. You identify as a man. And those pronouns do not fit your authentic self of who you are. And the same with non-binary people and the they, them, their pronouns that they use. So pronouns seem, you know, like a small thing, but they're very important as far as properly gendering and affirming someone.
Yes, words have a lot of power. I believe people don't understand that really too well nowadays. And a lot of people just, I think it comes from their own, you know, lack of discipline and taking care of themselves. And, you know, so they care less about other people around them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of it is someone's mindset in whether you're going to be progressive and flexible, or whether you're kind of dug in your beliefs and you don't want to change as society is changing and evolving.
Yeah, and it's just so odd sometimes, but I try to wrap myself around how people can't really progress like that. And a word comes up that I always come across is called cognitive dissonance. Like, it's almost like when you challenge someone's beliefs and it causes like a physical distress in their brains almost, which I personally, for one, I don't think I've ever experienced that. I don't remember a time of experiencing this, but I can see people out there experiencing this just on their faces whenever they're told something that they might be wrong on something or it goes against their beliefs. You see the pain in their faces almost.
Yeah. And I think it's the level of that uncomfortableness is heightened when perhaps you've lived a great deal of your life trying to overcome that and educate other people. And I think it's similar, you know, there's a lot of intersectionality between civil rights and LGBTQ rights, and we're certainly seeing the intersection of our communities and pushing back against racial brutality and racial injustice across our country, and there's a lot of intersectionality with LGBTQ people and fighting for equal rights as well. So I think this has been a very interesting time in the fact that we've seen, which is well overdue, we've seen so many black transgender leaders, so many black LGBTQ leaders who have stepped up to speak against racial injustice, and that the community is there and supporting them. This really comes from, in Orlando, an interesting thing happened after the Pulse tragedy, that we had a huge town hall where we gathered the community, and we had over 250 people attend. And several things came from that town hall. Number one was the germination, the formulation of which what is now the One Orlando Alliance that is doing such amazing work in Central Florida and in Orlando in supporting the LGBTQ community. And the other piece was that what we didn't know before Pulse was the Q Latinx community did not have a seat at the table. You know, our Q Latinx, our Latinx community was one of these communities who was there, and we had leaders who just didn't have a platform. They didn't have a seat at the table. So from that, we learned that we needed to always check ourselves and ensure that everyone, the diversity within our LGBTQ community is represented and has a voice. Lately, we've seen that our Black LGBTQ leaders who are now stepping up and being a voice for pushing back against racial inequity, we see that those voices are well overdue having that platform. And we see so many people stepping into the spotlight to speak their truth, to really push back against, you know, police brutality and systemic racism. And it's really a time to embrace those voices, because that diversity within our own community is so powerful, and it leads in so many different ways. Because we look at that, and we look at the intersectionality with the transgender community. Violence against the transgender community, especially against Black transgender women in Florida, has been alarming. In 2018, we were the epicenter for transgender violence in the country.
Really?
We led the country in transgender murders. We had 5 Black transgender women murdered in the state of Florida in 2018.
That's terrible.
Yeah. So, and that now, you know, that relates to what's happening now in reference to violence against the community, violence against the Black community, and that's where we all need to come together and push back against this hate and violence.
I completely agree. Because I view society like the human body. Right now, what social media has done is basically given us the MRI for society. And right now, our body is fighting back against a long embedded disease in it. And I'm seeing that. So when people tell me we live in the worst times, I'm like, I don't believe that. I believe we're living in the best times because we're attacking a problem and we're growing from it. You know, the worst timeline would be we never say anything at all.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's been interesting that, sadly, this pandemic, COVID-19, has exposed a lot of inequities in our society. So we see that there's inequities in reference to healthcare. You know, underserved and underrepresented communities, the Black community, the Latinx community, are underrepresented, have, you know, less access to quality healthcare, certainly issues in reference to incarceration and dealings with law enforcement disproportionately impacts minority groups within our society. So we're seeing all of these, you know, underlying issues that have been in America for hundreds of years. COVID-19 is exposing those to a time where hopefully we can finally address these and move forward so that everyone, you know, is treated equally under the law in the country.
Because I believe we're that much closer to going towards something we could actually celebrate.
Yeah.
Like, we're there. We're almost to, we're maybe 100 or less years from utopia. Who knows? I believe that we're almost there.
Yeah.
Personally, it's just.
And it doesn't seem that hard, right? In the fact that people simply want to be treated equally. You know, everyone simply wants to be treated equally under the law, equal rights, equal protections. It doesn't seem like such a difficult concept, but, you know, we haven't gotten it right for 400 years now, so.
So, I guess we're
going to try. Work to be done.
A lot of work to be done, and I thank social media every day, to be honest, just for putting all this in our faces right there to where it's immediate, it's there, it's in your face, you can't deny it, and it's, we have to address it. I absolutely love that. It may upset people, but how can you get anything changed if you're not upset about what's currently happening?
Yeah, and I think it's been really interesting to see the protests around the country and seeing the diversity in the protests. You know, there's people of all races, all colors, ages, But certainly seeing, you know, the Gen Xers and the Gen Ys, Gen Zs and millennials, you know, the younger generation certainly is coming from a place of feeling empowered. You know, they're the generation of, you know, shooting violence across the country, you know, not feeling safe in your schools. And now seeing this systemic racism that we are experiencing, especially sadly, in reference to law enforcement, this is a generation who really, I think, is engaged and galvanized to really make a change. And I think it'll start, I hope, it'll start with this election, and that momentum will continue with this generation who are so connected through social media, like you say, so powerful, and such an amazing tool to put together rallies, to put together voices, to speak out against social injustice, and truly a motivating factor in this new generation who are really emerging as a powerful force to be reckoned with.
It is. It really is. And it's a wonderful time capsule, too. I believe we'll have probably true history, like the best, truest form of history because of how connected we are now. There won't be the old saying of the victors write history. I don't believe that saying will apply much anymore in the next coming years. You might be victorious, but we'll know who lost the war and why.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're going to switch gears. We're going to go from fifth gear down to third gear and go back. And I want to know more about how the family is now. How has your family adjusted to, I'll use your words since I saw your TEDx talk, your rebirth?
Oh, well, my family, when I transitioned, was amazing. And it was really led by my mom. My mom has always been somewhat the anchor of our family. And again, two brothers and two sisters, so there's five of us total. So I talked to my mom a great deal when I was planning on transitioning. And she was concerned for my welfare, certainly. And she also wanted to know more. So, and I learned a lot of this after the fact, but my mom checked out a lot of books. My mom did a lot of research to understand what it meant to be transgender, how to support a transgender, one of your transgender children. And after I came to the point where I told my mom that I was finally there and I decided I was going to transition. It was very difficult for my immediate family, my wife of 26 years, and I guess that's the most painful aspect of my journey, is my soulmate, my best friend. She was very honest in saying to me that this wasn't what she signed up for, that she wasn't a lesbian, so if I was going to transition, then our marriage would be over. And so that was a very painful experience. Both of my children, we had time to sit down and talk about it. And while there was certainly some bumps along the way, my children have been very positive over the years and still are. My extended family, I didn't know that my mom actually went out and bought Jennifer Boylan's book, She's Not There. And my mom read Jennifer Boylan's book, a transgender advocate who was kind of like, who passed the torch to my generation kind of thing. And Jenny Boylan's book was so amazing. I read it, and oftentimes I would read a page and I would think to myself, that's exactly the conversation that I had with my wife of transitioning, because she also had a wife and was dealing with that. But my mom, little did I know, my mom bought the book and took a trip to each one of my brothers and sisters' homes, because we all have like two children, and she gave the book to my brothers and sisters and told them to read this, and that Greg would soon be making, connecting with you to come over and visit. So what I didn't know is that my mother had given them the book so that they would have some information. And then I, you know, said, hey, let's get together, and not really any topic in mind. And so I went to my brothers and sisters' homes, and we sat down over a big glass of wine or something, and I told them what I was dealing with and what I was planning on doing. I was so fortunate in the fact that they had read the book, so they had a foundational understanding of what it meant to be transgender and kind of the dynamics in what that looks like with your family members, what that looks like with your spouse and your children. So they understood those dynamics, and they were very supportive. I have to say that thanks to my mom's insight and love and really looking out for me, that she really paved the way for my transition with my family to be overall a very positive situation.
And that actually answers my other question too, because I was going to ask you what kept you going during your transition, and your family seems like they were the most wonderful people to be around. When I've heard stories of people's families just absolutely turning away and just walking out on people.
Yeah. Well, and you're right in the fact that I have been fortunate there. My family has been supportive, yet cooler than before. We're not as close. My parents have passed away since then.
My condolences.
Thank you. So we've kind of lost that connectivity that sometimes happens with extended families when parents die. But where I found my energy and I found comfort and I found support was really in the LGBTQ community. You know, soon after I transitioned, I was contacted by the HRC steering committee here in Orlando, and they asked me to come to lunch and said, similar to what I was talking about with the Q Latinx community and that kind of thing, they were saying, we need transgender voices in Orlando. And we saw there was an article in the paper that hit about my transitioning, and they wanted me to be involved and work with HRC here in Orlando to educate, to lift up voices, and to try to bring more transgender people into the fold and into these safe spaces that they were trying to connect and create. So in joining HRC, I soon, you know, learned about the Pride Chamber, the Metropolitan Business Association, got involved in that, was elected president there for two terms, and we put on Come Out with Pride, you know, from the chamber at the time.
That was the event that gathered almost 100,000 people a year for Orlando, isn't it?
Yeah, yep. Still does. Well, not this year, but yeah. Unfortunately. Come Out with Pride gets larger every year, and the people that work at Come Out with Pride are just amazing. There's so much work to be done in creating that massive party for the community.
I just want to ask, what are the logistics like in putting that together?
They're huge because the different aspects of Pride, when you kind of slice and dice it, we have the various vendor booths around Lake Eola. So there's someone orchestrating that or a team orchestrating that. There's the actual Pride parade itself, which is, you know, you think about, we have at this point, the Pride parade has gotten so large that the head of the snake catches the tail of the snake. You know, we're recently, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of how do we increase the route of the parade so it doesn't, you know, like connect. So the parade gets bigger and bigger. We have a program where we have elected officials speak and things like that. We have advertisers. We're reaching out to corporate sponsors, or they are. But those are all the aspects in reference to what it takes to come out with Pride. Security, working with the city for permits, all that kind of thing. So it's a huge undertaking. Right. And the folks that come out with Pride should be just cherished. You know, they are amazing folks, and many of them have worked on Come Out with Pride for numbers of years. So amazing people doing amazing work.
How hard was it to find that team, or was it just they came all together?
Well, a lot of people, volunteered. At the time, Come Out with Pride was a part of the chamber, so a lot of our board members were a part of that committee that also did Come Out with Pride. It's since separated so that there's the chamber who focuses on supporting small businesses from the LGBTQ community and then come out with Pride, has its own 501c3 now. And they have an amazing team, you know, that people who are just dedicated to ensuring that this happens. And it's so important that it does. I think sometimes people don't understand the impact of Pride. Yeah, it's a huge party, and yeah, it's a huge visibility piece for the community. But I personally experienced a situation that really brought it home to me in reference to what Pride meant. I had this, I still do, I have this uncle who lived in Tennessee. He was a Baptist minister in Tennessee and struggled with who he was for a while. His wife passed away, and he was doing some traveling, and I invited him to come down during Pride Week. So he accompanied me through Pride and all the inner workings and the outer workings and that kind of thing. And soon there, after that, he called and said how much that impacted his decision to finally be his true self. And it wasn't an easy journey because he was a Baptist minister at this church for years and years. He had this huge congregation who loved him. His sons were both ministers. So him coming out at that point in time was a very difficult thing. He ended up moving to Florida and is living happily with his husband now. But it's so gratifying that what was kind of that point of, yes, I can do this, was because he felt the love and the camaraderie of all these people who were, again, bracing their authenticity and being themselves, coming out, and he felt that energy and that love from being at Pride, and that's what finally made him, you know, take that step, and a very difficult step in, you know, his particular journey coming from a conservative part of Tennessee and a family who certainly wasn't that accepting.
That is an amazing story. That is a very
brave
story.
What Come Out With Pride's all about, right?
It is. It's supposed to be, like how you described it. I can't put it any better than how you put it. And that leads us to the conclusion. And I want to end this by saying thank you for being a part of this podcast today, Gina.
Thank you so much. It was a great discussion. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's an honor to have been invited. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I wanted to add that Boris and I want to offer you this gallery for any fundraising purposes or anything that you see fit. We will hand this gallery to you. Just ask us. And I want you to help me be a better ally to the transgender community as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Anything I can do, hopefully down the road when we start coming together again as community, you know, live and sharing in mixers and things like that, we'll certainly want to do that.
I would definitely enjoy that.
Me too. Let's do it.
All right, we will. And everyone, thank you for listening to another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. I look forward to talking to all of you again soon.
Who know where I go, but right now I know there's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me, just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me.
The Experience with Chris Fio is produced by Boris Douglas Garvey and Kyle Eagle. It is a joint production of Borma, Vonti, and PFT Media. The theme song is You and Me by NMR Superstar.
A PFT Media production.